I'm Eric Buckenmeyer, and today, the 20th of May, 2019, March, 20th of March, 2019, I am interviewing Justin Corneal. So let's get on with it. Let's start with background. Can you tell me a little bit about yourself and about your family, Justin?
I guess the broadest overview would be my mother's side of the family is from Mexico. My father's is Norse and German. I was born in Chicago at UIC Hospital, and we lived in the Chicagoland area until I was 9. We lived in the city proper until I was 5. Then we moved to southern Indiana. It's a town called New Albany. It's right on the Ohio River, just north of Louisville, Kentucky. Very different. Then we moved up to Sun Prairie, Wisconsin in 2000, and I've lived in the Madison area since then.
Okay. Gonna kind of approach these next two questions together, just in case they overlap. I have a feeling they will to a certain degree. So why did you choose UW-Madison, and why did you want to follow the archives track in the information school?
So when I was finishing my undergrad, I had a capstone class, and all we did was read Herman Melville. That's it. And we had to do a final paper. And Herman Melville has a story called Benito Sereno, and it's about a slave ship where the slaves take over, they overthrow the captain, and this story is about somebody from a different ship boarding that ship and just seeing how uneasy the relations were amongst the crew. It's a really tense story. It's a really strange story. Edgar Allan Poe, who is one of my favorite American authors of all time, has a story called, and I can never get their names right, but it's The Curious Case of, or The Curious System of Dr. Tar and Professor Feather, or Professor Tar and Dr. Feather. It's one of the two. But that story is about, I believe, a Frenchman who is going to check in on an insane asylum. The insane asylum has been taken over by the inmates, who are treating the doctors and the nurses like they are the patients. So everything is topsy-turvy in here. And at one point, because nobody's locked up anywhere, the inspector says, well, you know, this is a really unusual method. Isn't it a problem? And the inmate who's leading him on his tour says, no, we've only really had a problem with one particularly stupid reporter, but he was dealt with pretty easily. And the entire story is a joke. So they approach these two stories from radically different angles, and it's the same basic story. So my project for this capstone class was, how did Melville and Poe feel about each other's writing? Because they were semi-contemporaries. Poe died right when Melville was starting to reach his sort of full power in the literary scene. But both New Englanders, both in the New England publishing scene. Poe was from the Mid-Atlantic coast. So I started to research that, and I researched it hard for about 7 weeks. And what I found out is that it is unknowable. There is exactly one document. It is a handwritten ledger from a hotel that says that Melville and Poe were there on the same day, but historically, Poe has also been stated to be at a temperance rally states away, and because it was like the 1840s, everybody who could possibly know firsthand is long dead. So the answer is maybe, but we can't know. At which point I became terrified because I was not going to have a paper to turn into my professor. So I went to my professor and I was like, what would you like me to do? We're kind of done here. And my professor, who had literally just finished his doctorate program, said, well, you learned an important lesson, which is sometimes your paper fails. And I was like, all right. So we came up with an alternate paper. And I attacked it the same way. It was sort of the same thing, but I used, not direct interactions, but Edgar Allan Poe left a ton of writing behind on, like, what constitutes good writing, and Melville did the same thing, and so I synthesized something out of that. But what I discovered is that I really love research. I was calling the New York Public Library because they have a lot of the Melville manuscripts and talking like directly to the people who handle those and asking them like bizarre questions. Like, can you tell me in the manuscript, is this word in this chapter italicized in the manuscript, or was that a publication? Was that a publication decision? Because it conceivably, if you're doing a close reading, validates or invalidates your interpretation. What I found out later is that that's not normal. Most people don't just really love research to find stuff out. Like, it's much more goal-oriented. And so when I found out that you could do that, like, that it's a career option to just preserve all this information so that when people who love research or are doing research need it, like, you can help them, that was really exciting. So I started applying to... here and UW-Milwaukee, because they also have a library school. And then once I got into library school, that's when I found out that archives was a specialization, and then I got really excited, because before that I thought it was just kind of one field. Like, I knew I wanted to do that, I knew I wanted to work with manuscripts, I knew that those were at the library, so if I want to get into libraries, then I got to go to library school. And then once I got here, I was like, oh, I can get super specialized. Like, let's go.
Okay. Yeah, that's really cool. So I noticed your career history has a lot of service-oriented jobs in it. You worked as... help me out here. You were a teacher in a tutor in a school for a little bit, and you also worked at Toys R Us and in an auto parts store. There we go.
Yep.
Is that a draw for you as well? Is there any common denominator? Because of course this profession is very service oriented.
I suppose in the broadest sense, yes. In that I like helping people. Going back even further than that, one of my first jobs was in a group home for people with traumatic brain injuries. And that's probably the strangest job I've had. Like, not... It was rewarding and also kind of soul-crushing, because that's just really draining work. But it's... All of my jobs have had a really... strong focus on helping people. That was a thing that both of my parents instilled in me a lot, was that the best thing that you can do with your life is help other people. So in that context, yes. I would be lying if I said that part of the reason that I stayed at Toys R Us so long was not that, like, I just kind of felt trapped there, and I didn't really know what else I could do. But even so, like, there is something like uniquely fulfilling about helping a kid find the toy that they want, especially if they don't know the name of the toy because they're a child, and so they just describe it and you're like, yeah, I know what that is, follow me and we can take you there.
So speaking of Toys R Us, you were working for them when they essentially collapsed.
Yeah.
Well, what was that like? What happened to the employees when that was going on?
Oh, boy. So without having, like, a firm dateline in front of me, I will recount it as best I can. And in a word, it was strange. It was very strange. So they announced that they were going to go bankrupt before season. And any time that I or a retail worker talks about season, it's like November 1st through like mid to late January. It's the Christmas season. It's when everything ramps up. It's just kind of hell. It's grueling. It's largely thankless. If you're going to get yelled at by customers, it's going to be during season. Just everybody's kind of miserable. It's just not real fun. On the retail side. And so they announced that they were filing for bankruptcy before season. But not that they were closing down. And it was really strange because I should also say I worked at Toys R Us for 10 years. So I was pretty familiar with the workings of Toys R Us. And Toys R Us was actually a profitable company. What I didn't know at the time was that they also had, I believe, $500 million in debt. Nope, sorry. It was $5 billion in debt. Right, that they were trying to pay down. And it's almost impossible to be profitable if you have to pay down $5 billion in debt. So at the time, I didn't realize that it was as bad as it was. I was like, yeah, bankruptcy, and then they'll restructure, and they'll be fine, because they're making money. It'll be good. Well, then again, before season, they announced that it was not going to be fine. They were going to close some of the stores. Oh, well, that's not good. I knew I worked at the one here in Madison. There was only one Toys R Us in the Madison area. I knew we were going to be okay because we were the only Toys R Us in the Madison area. They weren't going to close us. They weren't going to close Milwaukee. And so that was okay. Where it started to get really hairy was when they announced that they were going, again, all of this is before season, which just extends the stress of everything. They announced that they were going to be formally shuttering all the stores, I believe, before season. And for me, it was rough for everyone, right? Because all of a sudden, your whole, like, everything is in a tailspin because you need to start looking for work now. Because you know you can ride out Christmas, but then nobody knew how long we had after the Christmas season. And so, personally, I was incredibly stressed because there was a while where I had my application for UW-Madison in to come to library school. And I started focusing on applying here because I knew people connected with the program who had nothing but good things to say. And truthfully, because my undergrad record was not super awesome, so I figured people who knew decision makers in the program and were willing to help me out and put in a good word for me was something I needed. But so I had my application in here, but I hadn't heard back from them yet. And my job was going away. So I was in this real weird place where I was like, well, if I get in, that's fine, because I can go to school and then work around school. But if I don't get in, then I'm really going to have to scramble, because there's going to be a lot of stuff up in the air, and then I got to figure out, you know, do I apply again for grad school next year, or do I just, you know, move on and, you know, find a grown-up job. But I got into Madison, so that solved itself. And then it, and that's when things got real strange. Really strange, because they announced, after they announced that, that they were going to be liquidating, that they were going out of business, they sort of did that in stages. So at first they weren't liquidating the whole company. They were just shutting down some stores, but nobody knew what stores were getting shut down because they didn't tell us at the store level anything. I found out that we were filing for bankruptcy, on Twitter. Yeah, not from like any official email or official meeting, nothing. I woke up one morning and checked Twitter and they were like, Toys R Us is going bankrupt. And I was like, huh, well, that's, that's strange. So that's how I found out. And then when they were talking about closing down stores, it was bizarre because the messages that we got from management were that everything was fine. But we knew it wasn't fine. And it created this like tremendous sense of uneasiness among all of the employees because it sort of like arrested your plans. Because if you were going to be fine, there were enough people there that were not full-time, but for whom this filled what they needed, right? This was their second gig or whatever. And so for them, if this was going to stay around, then they didn't need to go find a new place. And if it wasn't, then they did, but it was just very, very strange. So we made it through. We made it through season, and it was a trying season for all the normal reasons, but also customers at Toys R Us, some were wonderful. We had some regular customers that I loved, and every once in a while, one of them will see me like in Madison, and they'll say, hey, how's it going? You know, and that's great. But Toys, specifically, also has some of the most difficult and awful people on the planet buying them. And I worked in auto parts, right? Like, I worked with mechanics who were half in the bag all the time and just angry about part pricing and angry about this and angry about that. And nothing compared to toy shoppers. And so this particular season was that, and after a while you just sort of get numb to that and you're like, okay, well, I know how to deal with this. But then you would also have them explaining to us, the people who worked at Toys R Us and had a better handle on what was going on in Toys R Us than at least 80% of the population. But they would come in and explain to us why Toys R Us was going bankrupt. And they were wrong. Like, categorically, because the reason Toys R Us was going bankrupt was because they got purchased by a private equity firm who raided everything and then, like, just sank the company. But we would have people come in and they would explain that our prices were too high or we didn't stock enough like, essentially, like, we didn't have the thing they wanted at the price they wanted to pay for it, and that's why we were going out of business. So, all right. But we made it through that, and then the really strange stuff came after season, because after season, they started closing stores down. And when they started closing stores down, those stores would sell everything that they could, and then what they couldn't sell, they would send back to the warehouse, and that stuff would go to different stores that were served by the same distribution center. So all of our shipments just started getting real strange, like real wild. And there was no rhyme or reason to anything that we were getting. And then, on top of that, like, we would still get our regular shipment. So you would get a truck, and it would be, like, 1,700 pieces, so 1,700 boxes, and, like, 300 of them would be Barbie. And you're like, well, what are we going to do? We're never going to sell through this. What the hell are we supposed to do with it? So we would put it in the back, and eventually we sold through it, because we sold through everything. I'll get there. That's the liquidation days. But you would also get people calling the store, and you would pick up. And I would work a lot of customer service at the time, so you'd get a real robotic response to the phone, and you pick it up. Thanks for calling Toys R Us Madison. This is Justin. How can I help you? And the voice on the other end would go, "Are you guys still open?" And say, yes, we are. And then they would say, well, when are you guys going to close? And I would say, I honestly don't know. If I knew, I would tell you. Okay. And then they would hang up. We would get that a lot. We would get a lot of people asking when you're closing. A lot of people would be like, well, what are you going to do when this place closes? Which, for the record, like, I don't know who's going to listen to this, but if you do listen to this and you go to a place that's going out of business, unless you have an established relationship with the people who work there, don't ask what you're going to do when this place closes. It's terrifying. And if you don't have, like, a solid plan in place, it's, like, just terror-inducing. Like, flop sweats, hand shaking, because you don't know. And, like, when your job is going away, like, it's real scary. It was okay for me, because I would be like, well, I'm starting grad school in the fall. And they'd be like, oh, good for you. And truthfully, by the time it got to that point, most of us had something figured out. But we just kind of marched forth in that weird atmosphere for a while. Just, you knew the axe was gonna fall. You just didn't for sure know when. And then we got, all of us got FedExed a piece of paper from Toys R Us Corporate that gave us the earliest termination date. And they were like, this is the earliest that your job will be done. I believe it was April, end of April. I still have that piece of paper because it's wild. It's one of the strangest pieces of mail I've ever gotten. And so then you knew. And then when people were like, well, when are you closing? I was going to be like, well, this is probably somewhere around here. We didn't. We ended up staying open into June. But the liquidation started. And liquidation was really strange because the liquidation was handled by a third party, which I gather is fairly common. But essentially what it meant for us is that we at the Toys R Us store were working past when Toys R Us as a corporate entity had been liquidated. So, like, towards the end, we were working, but there was no HR. Because HR had been done. They were corporate. Corporate Toys R Us no longer needed to exist because the store existed, but the store was being run by whoever the third-party liquidator was. And for me, that was super liberating because the message that I took away from Toys R Us corporate no longer being a thing was I no longer needed to be nice to pain-in-the-ass customers. Because there's no HR. What are you going to do? Call and complain on me to an office that doesn't exist? All right. No, we don't have it. Where are you going to get it? No, probably not. Like, was this going to be on a greater sale? Like, yeah, probably in a little bit, but we'll sell out before then. Do you want it or not? And that was super liberating. That was my favorite part, is they were regular customers who were assholes, and I no longer had to be nice. Again, if you're listening to this out there, I'm pretty nice It's the reason I was able to survive retail for so long. So I'm not just out there like, no, fuck you, get out. But liquidation started, and they started doing sales on everything. And all of a sudden, foot traffic in the store just skyrocketed. But it brought in a whole bunch of new and uncomfortable questions. It was all the questions about, like, well, how long are you guys going to stay open? Just quadrupled. And we'd get them all the time. And they would start doing tiered sales. So everything in the store was 10% off, and then everything in the store was 20% off, and then everything was 30%, and so on and so on. And I think the highest we got to was 50% off. Hmm. What was strange about that, if you were in the store, is that all of the other sales and markdowns got annihilated before that, and so everything went back up to the manufacturer's suggested retail price. So stuff that literally was like $15 before the liquidation started all of a sudden jumped up to like $25 but 10% off. So a bunch of people got mad about that. And they would complain to you, and it was really strange because you're like, what do you want me to do? We're going out of business. Like, I don't know what you expect us to do. And they were like, this is why you're going out of business. You're like, well, this isn't it, because this is after that's already been decided. That's not how cause and effect works. But whatever. So the liquidation started, and that was really strange, because people would come in, and the psychology of shoppers just got really weird, because they would find stuff, and they would be like, oh, I really want this. It's like, all right, no. Well, is it going to be cheaper in the future? And, like, the only honest answer you could give, and it's the answer I gave all the time, was, yes, but we can't hold anything, and we're not doing returns or exchanges on anything. So, if you want it, there are probably other people who also want it. So, if you want it really badly, buy it now. If you are comfortable missing out, then sure, wait. But waiting is a gamble. And if we're out, we're out. We're not getting any more. That's it. And some people took that well, and some people got really upset. And then as we started selling through stuff and had empty shelves, the third-party liquidator brought in stuff from other stores that they had liquidated that had nothing to do with the Toys R Us purview. So there were, like, we were getting in, like, plate sets and hammocks and, like, yoga mats and just all kinds of stuff. And as we're unloading, I'm like, all right, I don't know who the hell's going to buy this. Tons of people bought it. It turns out that, like, at a certain percent, I want to say it was, like, 30%. At 30%, people would just buy, like, whatever. Like, they just came in and it hell-bent on buying something for 30% off. And they would. So we ended up selling out just about everything. And then we physically dismantled the store. We took down the shelving. We took down the displays. We sold, like, everything that was in there. It was kind of Toys R Us policy towards the end, where, like, if you can sell it, sell it. We had a ton of people asking about displays that couldn't be sold because displays, if you're familiar with, like, Lego displays in like, department stores or used to be Toys R Us, they have that sort of clear plastic display that's got all the Lego sets in a line put together and glued together, and they're set up in a little scene. Those actually don't belong to the store. They belong to Lego. Lego puts them in, and then those stores aren't allowed to sell them. So if we could sell it, we sold it. For those, we couldn't. And you actually had to you had to throw them in the trash compactor because they weren't ours to sell. So that was weird. We had a lot of people asking about that. We had a lot of people who were confused by the all sales are final thing. because once we weren't doing returns or exchanges, all sales are final, and people would buy something and be like, oh, my kid didn't like this. And you're like, well, you can't take it back. All sales are final. They would get real mad. So that wasn't fun. But again, you didn't have to be nice anymore. So you could just be like, well, it's yours now. Look, I don't know what you want me to do about it. And then, like, no matter what, you would just be like, sorry, it's clearly listed. It's right there. But yeah, and then tearing down the store was really strange, because it was a place that I'd been going to for 10 years, and like, you leave and it's wide open and empty, and it's just kind of crazy. It's the only time when there was in my entire career there, where there was a concentrated effort to not sell things to the public if somebody that worked there wanted them first. It was specifically a Funko Pop that was Jeffrey the Giraffe, and it was flocked, so it had like faux fur on it. And we got in one box, and we were like, well, these aren't going out on the floor. If you want one, let us know, and then you would buy them. So I have one of those. But yeah, it was just a really strange wind down. And then I expected there to be almost more emotion the last day walking out, because as much as I hated working Toys R Us, and by the end, make no mistake, I did, but it was an exhausting job where I would deal with pain-in-the-ass customers all the time. And then later when I worked there, they put me at customer service because I was patient and had a very long temper. And I was good with dealing with customers. But it after a while, that stuff takes its toll. And so I was ready to be done. But it's still 10 years. I expected there to be something more impactful, and there just kind of wasn't. And I think it's because for so long, it was just kind of a zombie store that when it ended, you were just like, yeah, this is it. There was nothing to say goodbye to, because you had been making your peace with it being done for 7 months. So by the time it was finally done, you were just kind of like, well, that's the end of that. And I was very lucky. The most infuriating thing to me is that they didn't have severance packages for like anyone. So my manager had MS, and they had no severance package for him. He was just out. One of the assistant managers was battling cancer, and there was no severance package for that. And not to say that there should only be severance package if you're facing adverse conditions, but for those two people especially, like, it was one where I was like, how are you guys doing? And they had plans. Their spouses had jobs that could cover them. But it was a really one-sided affair. And it was difficult to feel anything but sort of numb and vaguely resentful for the way that it all went down. And I think that's the overview. Again, if I had like a calendar and I could give you the timeline, it'd be more specific, but I think that's most of it.
About how long was it between when the store finally went kaput and you actually matriculated and began school here?
So I had graduated before they were closing. And then I got accepted, and Then my plan became to work at Toys R Us until they went out of business, and then to collect unemployment until school started. And I collected unemployment for about 2 months. And it was the first, like, true summer vacation I had had where, like, I didn't have to go to work every day or didn't have something going on in... probably around 20 years. So that was awesome. Like, that was truly great. But yeah, that was probably about 2-3 months.
Okay.
2-3 months.
Okay. So we're going to change gears a little bit here.
Sure.
And talk about one last thing. You had described yourself to me as a passing white. So I was curious what that has been like for you, and how people have interacted with you and viewed you, and how that has impacted you.
Oh, brother, that's one of those 48-hour interview questions. So I should clarify that I also lived my life with undiagnosed anxiety until I was probably around 30. Which I clarify only because I don't know how much of it is relating to my anxiety and how much of it is related to... passing for white. But it... so forgive me if I sound incredibly emo, but it's a thing I think about and I deal with a lot, because it's a thing that I didn't... that I wasn't even comfortable enough acknowledging to start dealing with it until I was in my late 20s. And I'm 34 now, so, you know, I've probably got 7 years of it under my belt. But it has caused for me a lot of one-sided distancing from my family, by which I mean my family is incredibly close and very loving. But on my mother's side, they're Chicanos, they're Latinos, and so they're dark, they're brown-skinned. And because I am significantly lighter, there is a part of me that has always felt that I am not Chicano, that I am pretending. And it's truly difficult. I'm sorry, I'm not trying to be evasive. It is
That's all right. Take your time.
It's really difficult for me to grapple with, and usually if I spend a lot of time talking about it, I start crying because it's hard. But it's hard because all of the terms that I have to express it are from struggles that are not mine. W.E.B. Du Bois, I believe, talks about the idea of the double conscious, or double consciousness, which is, specifically he was talking about black people in America, and that you learn who you are, and then you learn who you have to be to survive. And again, I'm not saying that my that my struggle is that struggle, but it is, I identify with that concept because I know who I want to be, but I have a difficult time knowing who I am. It was also exceptionally difficult in New Albany. It's a Southern Indiana town, and no matter what anybody tells you, Southern Indiana is the South. It is Kentucky. It just is. And it was the first place that I ever heard a lot, like, oh, well, you don't seem Mexican or you don't look Mexican. And that's well-trod ground. You know, that's there's nothing novel to add there. It's a shitty thing that you shouldn't say. What I can say is that it produced for me an even stronger feeling that I was pretending, right? That nobody could look at my grandfather or my cousins or my uncles and say, well, they don't look Mexican, because they do. And so it really compounded the feeling that I was pretending. On top of that, I didn't know Spanish. My grandfather and my great grandparents were the only people that spoke it to me when I was growing up. And that's because my grandpa Raul, who's my great grandfather, and my great grandma Reina, spoke at best broken English. And so for them, like, they would speak Spanish because that's what they knew. That's how they could express themselves. And my grandpa would speak Spanish because we would go over to their house and they would all speak Spanish. And so I heard it, I could understand it, and I could make the sounds. I just couldn't speak the language. And that was another thing that for me felt false. So I didn't learn Spanish. I started in high school, and I couldn't trill my R's until literally I was 32, and I had to do it for Spanish phonetics. It was a class. I had to learn how to do it for a grade. And it's funny. This one's legitimately funny to me. I spent a good 3 weeks by myself anytime I was alone just trying to make the sound. And so I would just be in my car, and I learned everything. People were like, oh, you start and you say butter, and then you just say it faster and faster. You know, butter, 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 brrr. And I was like, no, that's... I could say butter pretty fast. It's the from butter to... That's the hard part. And so instead what I did was I just, I would drive to Whitewater and back. It was about an hour drive each way. And so about 2 hours a day for about 3 weeks. Plus whenever I was alone in my house and nobody was around for me to annoy or to laugh at me, I would just kind of go, and then I did it one day and it was just, oh yes. And so I got my phone out and I was recording the sound, on my phone to play it back to make sure that I was doing it. Because I also learned that there's two ways to do it. And there's the French way that happens in the back of your throat, which I learned first. But only the French and then some Caribbean Spanish speakers do it that way. Mm-hmm. But so I learned that and I felt really good about myself. Because now I could do it. And it was just one step closer. But I think probably the best illustration of what it was like for me is I got into an argument with someone one time. I don't even remember what it was about. But it was something regarding Latinos. And the guy I was arguing with looked at me and said, of course you think that, you fucking spick. And I got so excited and happy that a stranger had looked at me and said, Mexican, spick. I became visibly happy and excited And the argument was over, because when somebody throws a racial slur at you and you're just like, thank you so much. Like, they don't know how to respond. And so, like, to this day, I look back at it and I'm like, you know what? That was a really good day. And I know objectively it's not that I shouldn't be excited. But that's where I was at the time. Like, just any acknowledgement that, like, yes, the world sees you as you view yourself in any context was just so rewarding for me that I was like, this is a win. This is, it doesn't matter. I understand. And that dude hates me. I don't care. He hates me for a reason that I embrace. And so that's it. I'm happy to answer questions about it. It's just, it's a difficult thing for me to express outwardly. It's tough. Because mostly what it did was it set me up with a pattern that later in life I wanted to reject, right? Because I don't want to pass for white now. I'm very proud to be Chicano. Like, it's a thing that I wear incredibly proudly, and I'm proud of my family. One of the reasons I'm really excited about Archives Now is the idea that that I can go into this field and make sure voices like the voices of my family aren't lost anymore. But I also have to sort of unlearn all of those things that I learned that I use to pass. Which isn't to say that I don't also identify with the white side of my family. I do. It's just passing sort of sublimates a huge chunk of yourself. And so for me, I had to sublimate what I believe is a big chunk of myself. And so I'm sort of having to go through and reclaim that. And it's difficult. And it's difficult to express because I don't necessarily have the words for it. And all the analogs are to people whose struggle is much greater than mine. It's, you know, it's, I identify with trans people, not to say that my struggle is the same as theirs, but the idea that the world is telling you that you are something you are not is a thing that I identify with. And so for a lot of those sort of liminal groups where the world is like, yeah, but not really, it's for me personally, I can't feel anything but compassion to say, no, if this is who you say you are, then that's good enough for me. Then I believe that this is who you are. You get to tell people who you are, because that's how it works. And to be divorced from that is really tough. Really tough. Sorry, was I rambling?
No, you're good. So I think to wrap up the interview, I have one more question. How do you feel in your Chicano identity now? I mean, I would assume it's a work in progress, but do you think you've come a long way from where you started? Oh,
man. Now? Man. Orgulloso. Proud. And a part of it, honestly, I think is I'm 34 now. Like, I've just reached a point where I'm kind of too tired to care what other people say. Like, I don't particularly need their acceptance. I've become much more comfortable in my skin. And, you know, I mean, again, that's greatly aided by the fact that I'm a man and I can pass for white. So I don't have to deal with the daily struggle. But it is one. I don't anywhere near as much feel like I am pretending when I visit my family. When I visit family in Mexico and I can speak to them in Spanish, I don't feel like I'm a novelty. And now it's things that used to be like kind of hurtful are kind of funny to me now. Like when I go down to Mexico and people are real surprised when they see me speak Spanish because I'm pale. That's fun for me now, right? Like when I go down with my cousins who don't speak any Spanish and they're darker than me, and people look at them and they're just like, I don't know. And then I can order things for them at a restaurant. Like that's fun for me now. Like there's a thing where I'm like, ha, I gotcha. And it's not, it doesn't feel like I'm divorced, from that part of myself. I'd be lying if I said that it was all good now. I mean, there are some days when it's still very difficult, I would say I'm making good progress. It's a much more out there pride. It's something that I wear much louder and much more upfront, and it's not really a thing that I concern myself about as much as I did. If I were to hear somebody say, well, you don't seem Mexican, it wouldn't hurt me. It would much more be one where it'd be like, well, what would seem Mexican? Like, just, you know, no, I'm not trying to flip it around and you'd be like, you're a racist piece of shit. But like, well, what would? Like, because I'm short, I'm stocky, I have curly hair. Like, everything about me, except that I'm not darker, is really like phenotypically Mexican. So like when you say it, I'm like, what doesn't work? Is it just skin color? And again, in good faith, not like you're a piece of shit, because the truth is, actually going down to Mexico helped a lot, because Mexicans come in all colors, even in Mexico, and that was a shock to me. But it was good, and so I would say, yeah, I like to think I'm making progress. But I mean, also, you know, I've been treating my anxiety, so that could be part of it. Like I don't know. I think I'm doing better, in terms of how to help other people. I have no idea. You just kind of keep chipping away at it, and eventually you just figure out what works for you.
Okay. Thank you very much for talking with me.
Yeah, of course.